Won't you take me to that place when I lose my sense of time, where I escape my fate, when I feel the most alive? Won't you play my favorite song, my favorite song, play my favorite song?
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday morning. It is the 10th of December, and it is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We welcome you to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. We have a lot to discuss. We have a great group. It's a day that is, it hasn't quite started to snow here, but there are parts of our region that are currently getting snow, and the forecast is not great for the day, so hopefully you can have an opportunity to sit back and listen to the show and enjoy it, or scream at it, or however you want to interact with it is fine by us. We have a great group. Let me introduce them to you. We begin with Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Bo Breslin. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning, Joe. Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program. We also welcome former New York 19th Congressman and New York Assemblyman John Faso joins us. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to be with you. Sorry I have to be remote today, but that was required.
Yes, it is not. It is fine. That is always good, and I'm just glad to have you here. So thank you for allowing your voice to beam into our program. Karen Riedel joins us by telephone as well, Associate Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College, President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Karen, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm calling in from rainy Westchester, and I'd much rather be in snowy Albany right now.
Yes. Well, I would probably take rainy Westchester, yeah. But I don't know. You know, it's either way, it's the weather is here, so we'll see how it goes to different parts of our region, and of course, we'll keep you on top of it throughout the day on our various weather reports. Let me go to the reminder that if you would like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, so we're going to talk about boat strikes again, and this is a story that just continues, and I don't know, it's one of those stories that I don't know how much more we have to advance on it other than the way this stands now is there seems to be a decision to be made by a person who is very much a part of all of this, Pete Hegseth, as to whether to release footage of the second strike on this boat and in regards to boat strikes in Venezuela. So now there's a pair of stories, and we can merge them together, but I think, start with the one having to do with, because yesterday was a busy day, and they were trying to figure out information on this. And in addition to that, they talked to the Admiral, Alvin Holsey, who is someone who has been very critical of Pete Hegseth. And he was, they expected him to be around for 3 years. He lasted for, one something, and said goodbye, and so he was talked to yesterday, and they had conversations yesterday with him from top members of the House and Senate committees. Now there is a scramble within the Pentagon, as described in the New York Times, where officials initially weighed sending survivors of U.S. attacks on boats suspected of drug smuggling to a notorious prison in El Salvador to avoid American courts. Well, This all now is looking at trying to get to the bottom of the story. And the in the Times reporting today, it said the Pentagon was in a bind. The military had plucked two survivors from the Caribbean Sea in mid-October after striking a boat the U.S. official said was carrying drugs, and it needed to figure out what to do with them. On a call with counterparts of the State Department, Pentagon lawyers floated an idea. They asked whether the two survivors could be put into a notorious prison in El Salvador, to which the Trump administration had sent hundreds of Venezuelan deportees. The State Department lawyers were stunned, one official said, and rejected the idea. The survivors ended up being repatriated to their home countries of Colombia and Ecuador. A little under 2 weeks later, on October 29th, Pentagon officials convened another session about boat strike survivors, a video conference involving dozens of American diplomats from across the Western Hemisphere. The message was that any rescued survivors should be sent back to their home countries or to a third country, said three other officials who, like others interviewed for the article, spoke on the condition of anonymity. Behind that policy was a quieter goal to ensure survivors did not end up in the U.S. judicial system, where court cases could force the administration to show evidence justifying President Trump's military campaign in the region. The previously unreported calls demonstrate the haphazard and sometimes tense nature of the process within the Trump administration to weigh what to do with survivors of U.S. attacks on boats that the military asserts, without presenting evidence, are drug smuggling vessels posing an immediate threat to Americans. Then add to this, of course, what we already know of the story where there were two quote-unquote survivors who were then killed with a second attack in a incident happening in early September. That reporting from the New York Times. So getting a little bit of context, but also muddying the waters quite a bit. Bo Breslin.
Yeah, Joe, this is the story that just keeps on giving. And I think we're probably only part of the way through really understanding the entirety of what's going on. There are a lot of threads, as you mentioned. I think I'm going to take a little bit of a, 5,000, 10,000 foot view and hope that Karen and Congressman Faso are able to sort of put a little bit more nuance to it. And I'm not generally interested in conspiracy theories, but nor am I buying the fact that the administration's assault on Venezuelan boats generally and on Maduro in particular is about drugs. Only 10% of the cocaine entering the U.S. comes from Venezuela. Colombia is a much bigger trafficker in cocaine. And so let's just play this one angle out, and that is this is about oil. Doesn't this remind you, Joe, of Bush saying that Iraq had, quote, a bad leader back then? And what's interesting is that Iraqi oil is still largely run by Iraqis, but foreign firms have significantly increased their influence in the country, in Iraq. Could Trump be trying a repeat, right? Could Trump be trying to eliminate Maduro as Bush tried to eliminate Saddam Hussein as a way to increase our commercial investment in Venezuelan oil? Isn't this possible given the following things? One, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves. That's been reported largely. Did anybody on the panel check out the White House foreign strategy paper that came out last week that specifically called for, quote, expanding our commercial influence in the Western Hemisphere, including Venezuela? Three, Trump's attempt to open oil drilling in the United States in places like Alaska is constantly tied up in courts. So it's actually difficult. It's been difficult for Trump to actually enable companies to actually do some drilling. And four, Venezuelan is a destabilizing force on our doorstep. So I actually think there's something to the idea that this really is about oil. And it's sort of a repeat of history, I think, at some level, with Bush trying to have some particular influence in the oil reserve question back in Iraq. I have a couple of questions that I'll hold off on for now, and they're rhetorical questions, but I think they're important. And listen to the excellence of the other two members of the panel.
Oh, good. I love having content to rely on later, just in case. John Faso.
Well, I think I don't know about how excellent this will be, but I think that largely what the administration is doing is to try to oust the Maduro regime, which is an illegitimate regime. That regime, Maduro rigged the so-called election that they had last year. And by and large, vast majority of countries around the world and many in Latin America recognized the opposition leader as having legitimately won that election. So I think that there's much, and I think that Bo's comment about the national security document is interesting as well, because we know that Venezuela has very deep links with not just Cuba, whose secret police basically keeps Maduro in power. And intelligence officers keep Maduro in power in Venezuela. But it's not just Cuba. It's also China and Iran, along with the Russians, that have significant tentacles into the Venezuelan regime. And so I think the Trump administration is making plain that they want to see Maduro out. And I don't think you send about a quarter of our national naval forces into the Caribbean if you don't have a aim of bringing the Maduro regime to an end. Oil, I'm not so sure that it has much to do with oil per se, although Venezuela is one of the largest has one of the largest oil reserves in the world, as was noted. And we know that Chevron has been operating in Venezuela, and the Maduro regime has basically, just like his predecessor, has wrecked the oil production in Venezuela because they allowed the system to deteriorate. It wasn't maintained properly, et cetera. So there's a lot of interest by Chevron in being able to operate in Venezuela. But I think that overall, the administration strategy, and we can talk about the boat attacks, et cetera, but I think the administration strategy is to try to bring enough outside pressure on Maduro for him to leave the country.
Karen Riedel.
I have a hard time imagining that this administration is focused on democratization in Venezuela because of the rigged elections that occurred. Of course, if that was the case, then we would certainly learn from the Iraq experience, among many others, that military actions rarely lead to a stable situation in the country and rarely succeed. So I don't think this is driven by any interest in democratizing Venezuela. Oil is certainly a nice little side effect, I would think, but I kind of wonder whether this is just a reflection of what Pete Hegseth stated the military mission to be, which is to show maximum lethality, not tepid legality, violent effect, not politically correct, because it certainly this is what describes our actions in the region. We should talk a little bit about the boats and just remind ourselves that there is really no legal basis in international law, national law, to attack these boats. Just by calling them narco-terrorists does not make them terrorists. We still don't have any evidence. We were told there is evidence that these are drug traffickers, but we have not seen any evidence in that regard. We also, there are claims repeated yesterday that that every boat that is destroyed saves 25,000 American lives, and there's no evidence on which to make these kinds of cases. In fact, it does appear that these boats were going in a different direction, not toward the United States. I think oil is always on the back of our administration's mind. Certainly, the democratization, that would be the ideal case, but a deeply flawed approach to democratization is through military action, and I find it difficult to imagine that this is the main priority of it. So I'm still struggling with understanding why we're doing what we're doing.
When we talk about why we're doing what we're doing, John, I'm interested in just this idea of the strikes themselves, and take it at the simplest level of what we're discussing, and I realize there's a lot of nuance to all of this, but there are members, top members of the House and Senate who have seen the tape, and even the president has said it's not pretty of the second strike. What is the advantage/disadvantage of showing that, and especially what's the advantage of showing it if your claim is accurate, not yours, but Pete Hegseth's claim is accurate, that everything was according to Hoyle?
Well, the administration designated these groups and Venezuelan President Maduro as a leader of a narco-terrorist group, and so that designation, they will argue, is what gave them the legal authority to conduct these strikes. And I would note that President Obama did something similar with groups that he designated as terror groups and conducted drone strikes on them. I would say that it was a lot clearer in the case of how Obama did the designation, that those were definitely terrorist groups. I think you stretch it a bit, as the administration has done in this instance, with these alleged drug traffickers and going after them in this way. I think that is definitely going to get more scrutiny from people in Congress on both the right and the left. But I think that the Maduro is definitely an illegitimate regime. His presidency is an antagonist to the United States. He's definitely against the democratic elections. We know that they rigged the last election, and they survived on the basis of terror and having the Cuban intelligence forces actually conducting his own security. And they have penetrated into a lot of levels in the Venezuelan military, according to many reports. So that makes it more difficult for Venezuelans who want to get rid of Maduro to actually take up arms against him. And it's also true that there have been some 8 million Venezuelans that have fled, not just coming to the United States, but most of them going into places like Colombia and Argentina, et cetera. So there's no doubt Maduro is a very bad guy, and there's no doubt that our adversaries internationally, Iran, Cuba, China, and Russia, are supporting Maduro. And so I certainly hope that the pressure campaign to get Maduro out works. But I think that the administration definitely runs a real risk if we have get into a military engagement in order to accomplish that. I think that would cause a lot of problems politically for the administration.
Bo.
John, I guess I'll follow up with a couple of with one central question, but with a little context. And the central question is, if the Trump administration is so focused on isolationism, especially with regard to the MAGA base that is increasingly frustrated with incursions overseas, we see that on a fairly regular basis from the base. If we are so isolationist, why try regime change here? It can't just be, maybe you'll have to school me on this, it can't just be that Maduro's a bad guy. There's lots of bad guys out there. It can't just be that Maduro is in the pocket of China and Russia. Trump is in the pocket of China and Russia. It can't be that it's about things like cocaine and so on, or it can't be, as Karen said, anti-democracy, because quite frankly, the Trump administration tries to dismantle democracy at home. So why Venezuela then? If and I agree with you, there's an attempt on the part of the Trump administration to get rid of Maduro, but A, you're not going to have boots on the ground. B, you probably could get rid of Maduro. There was a story in the news just the other day about how there was a negotiation about Maduro leaving, but it didn't work out. So tell me why Venezuela is the target. Is it just that it's simple to blow up the boats? I just don't get it.
Well, I think this, you look at that national security strategy that you referenced earlier, it's almost like in part, the justification is to revive a latter-day revival of the Monroe Doctrine, that in this hemisphere, the United States has serious and important national interests. And I think both the Biden administration and going back to Obama, I think that the Hugo Chavez was viewed as a malign force, adverse to the United States. And so I think that there's a long history of both Hugo Chavez and Maduro acting counter to United States and regional interests. So I think that you know, obviously, I'm not suggesting that Trump is on a democratization push for that purpose alone. But I do think that they've highlighted the illegitimacy of the Maduro regime and the malign influence that they and Cuba continue to have in that entire region. So I think that's one of the reasons why they're trying to push him out. And I would I lament, for instance, you talk about the isolationist tendencies among some on the right. I don't agree with those that say, for instance, that the United States doesn't have serious interest in preventing Russia from making Ukraine a vassal state, which is what Putin's aim is there. I mean, I don't agree candidly with the administration and their approach. And I note that the National Defense Authorization Bill, which is supposed to be passing the House and Senate shortly, has extra funds in it for aid to Ukraine, which is going to cause consternation among some in that MAGA base. But I think they're wrong. I think we should be supporting Ukraine, despite all the flaws that they may have internally, which I think we readily acknowledge. So the MAGA base is isolationist, and I think that they will object strongly to any kind of troops on the ground type of thing in Venezuela. And I don't think the American people are really would be supportive of that, nor are they ready for that, because I don't think the administration has really properly explained this whole enterprise to the American people as of yet.
Karen?
Yeah, the administration has not explained it, and of course it framed it again as a war against drugs. So it just reminded me of the Honduran former president Hernandez, who was pardoned, one of the main beneficiaries of the drug trade. By the way, just yesterday, the Honduran Attorney General announced that they had issued an international arrest warrant for Hernandez, who, of course, was just pardoned. So framing this the situation as something that would benefit us will help us fight the drug crisis is deeply misleading. So, as I said, I still don't know exactly what the ideas are, what the objectives are. The administration has not explained it well. They are framing it as a war on drugs, and it's simply not convincing to me.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go to some letters that we have from listeners. We welcome yours, panel@wamc.org. Panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Our discussion on Venezuela continues. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We do have letters. We'll get to them now. We go to Russ, who says, the Trump administration has made several overtures to Maduro. I can only imagine that these centered around preferred access to the oil fields. Otherwise, Trump has no interest in the welfare of the Venezuelan people, as shown by his revocation of temporary protected status. That from Russ. We go to Linda. First of all, the press should be focusing on all of the boats that are being bombed in the Caribbean and not just the second strike. What I fear is that the Democrats will be held responsible for defending a couple of drug dealers like we defended a tiny portion of the population of men competing in women's sports. It's going to kill us in the next election. Meanwhile, maneuvers are being made in Venezuela for an attack on land with no congressional oversight and no declaration of war. And this goes unreported for the most part, as does the constant dismantling of our democracy. We need to cover more than one issue at a time, and we need to cover issues that Democrats and Republicans both feel are important. That from Linda. We check in with John. If Pete Hegseth had nothing to hide, he would release the video of the second strike that killed the survivors. His adamant refusal to release the video infers that the survivors were murdered, and Hegseth is staging a cover-up to avoid criminal prosecution. Then we go to Chris. Chris says, I like conspiracy theories. Thank you for that. I believe that Trump is a con man and probably a long-term asset of Russia. Not discussing this because it is considered conspiracy does not do service to us, the listening public. Some of us hold these beliefs anyway. Why not discuss them critically? Some conspiracy theories may become conspiracy facts upon careful, rational study. Thank you again for not avoiding these dark places. That from Chris. And Anne says, hey, it's three simple letters, O-I-L. Yes, Karen.
Yeah, I'd like to build on the second letter a little bit, because the notion that this will backfire for Democrats, I always take issue with the focus on which political party will benefit from the situation that we're dealing with right now. I'm actually really heartened by the fact that there are Republicans who push to have the recording, the videos released for all of our representatives to see what has happened, but also for the general public to see what has happened. So to me, there is no question in my mind that the second strike is important to focus on, because no matter what we designate as groups, the second strike constitutes murder. Imagine the same scenario at home. If a drug dealers are attacked, some survive, and the security forces decide on a second strike to kill them off. I think this would lead, without a doubt, to a national outcry. Just because this happens in the high seas does not make it not murder.
I agree. I totally agree with what Karen said. Let me ask this question, right? I said I had a couple of questions. And in some ways, I love the fact that I'm on the show with John, because I think John offers us an opportunity to see what's sort of going on behind the closed doors in Congress. So John, let's say for the moment you're right that the Trump administration is really trying for regime change, at a minimum get Maduro out, but regime change on the whole. Is there anybody in Congress that's asking Pete Hegseth or whomever, What is the plan for rebuilding Venezuelan politically after Maduro's out? Is there anybody who is asking that in the same way that sort of, I think there wasn't a there isn't a great plan for rebuilding Gaza? Now, it's a different situation, but we're going into these sort of massive political changes without a concrete plan to get us out of there or rebuild what's existing. Is are Congress members asking that question? And if so, what do you think the answer is?
Well, I do think that you're raising a fair point, Bo. I do think that the situation in Venezuela, though, is nowhere near comparable to Gaza. I think Gaza is much more intractable and difficult for a whole variety of reasons. There is a healthy, thriving democratic force within Venezuela, and we saw the Venezuelan people voting overwhelmingly for the opposition candidate to Maduro in those elections. So I think that there's a much bigger possibility that the Venezuelans, if they get away from this yoke of this autocratic, totalitarian, thuggish leader that Maduro is, I think they have a much greater possibility to right the country and set it on the correct democratic path. So I'm highly confident that this could happen. The Venezuelans have a great history. They have natural resources. They, as I mentioned before, Hugo Chavez and Maduro destroyed their oil industry. And I do think that that's an area where they can rebuild readily, and they probably will need the help of entities like Chevron and others to help them do that. But I think they have a great opportunity if they can get rid of this guy. And I think that's what ultimately, even though it has not been properly explained to the American people, I think that is what the Trump administration is attempting to do. It's also what Biden was attempting to do. It obviously did not get anywhere with what Biden did. Didn't get very far with the efforts that President Trump initiated in his first term with Elliot Abrams on point on the Venezuelan issue during the first Trump administration. So I have no doubt that both there's going to be a very strong expatriate community of Venezuelans who will want to go back to the country, and that there's some potentially very good leadership and a democratic process to help that country restore itself after this horror show of it's over 20 years, Hugo Chavez and Maduro in power. Chavez originally took over in a coup in, I think, 1998 or 99, and he systematically destroyed the economy of that country. That's why 8 million Venezuelans have fled, and many of those folks will go back if Maduro is gone.
So, John, let me ask you about go ahead, Karen. I apologize. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, thank you. There are I'm no fan of Maduro, to be fair. And I agree with John that there are democratic forces within the country. And there are ways to strengthen these forces by investing in civil society, for example. I don't see a basis in international law that would allow the United States to use the military against another nation, whether we like the regime or not, whether the regime is legitimate or not, unless there is an imminent threat to our own security. John, what do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think you're correct, Karen. I think that and that's why I don't think there would be broad support in the country for the United States military involvement in Venezuela. I think the Trump administration is trying to use external pressure points to force Maduro out. But I don't think that the administration nor the public would be ready or willing to support direct military engagement in Venezuela.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you, John, is that a lot of this started with the Washington Post reporting and the question of war crimes. And, of course, Pete Hegseth was brought into this immediately. I'm interested in your thoughts on him and what seems to be a back and forth on, well, it seems many think that it's inevitable that they're trying to move him out, or maybe not. I don't know. But I do find it interesting that even the president, who can be his fiercest defender, often seems to be waffling on the issue and saying, you know, I think so. I don't know. It depends on what he says. And if I were Hegseth and I heard that coming out of the president's mouth, I would think, oh, I don't know how this is going to go.
Yeah, better check your appointment calendar to make sure you don't have too many commitments 6 months and a year from now. You know, I don't know. I mean, I hear different things from folks, not as Bo suggested that I know what's going on in the back rooms, because I don't. But I do have contacts, and I do sense a lot of ambivalence about Secretary Hegseth's performance among some Republicans that I talk to. Not everyone, but So we will see. But it's widely felt among people that observe the Defense Department that things are not exactly operating smoothly at the highest echelons there.
When we think about this, I guess, did you want to, Bo, say anything about Hegseth going?
But I want to ask the panel about, I think Trump yesterday, and it's going to be a topic I think we'll get to, Trump's Pocono speech, which I thought was fascinating.
At the fabulous Mount Airy Lodge.
<That's right.
laughs> Yes.
I think my understanding was that Trump sang the praises of, broadly, his people and mentioned some version of the fact that they are, you know, celebrity, you know, look great in front of a camera type. He had some rhetoric about that. Hegseth is the most visibly, TV personality of the group. So I'll throw it out to the panel. That is from central casting in the Trump administration. So is there a sense that Hegseth's job is safe, not because of the fact that he's competent, but because of the fact that he shows well in front of Fox News cameras?
Anyone on that? I guess not.
Sorry.
Silence the group.
I have a simple answer to that. I think that is keeping him in the job for longer than one would expect otherwise under the circumstances. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to, a couple letters. Vincent, I'm sorry, Teresa. The legitimacy of the Venezuelan regime is an issue for Venezuelans. Americans are tired of nation building. Drug trafficking is a problem in Venezuela and many, many other countries. Should we designate any leader of nations that traffic fentanyl to the U.S. narco-terrorists? This campaign is just another episode in the Trump administration's reality TV show-style government. If they can rob Venezuelans of their natural resources and distract Americans from the administration's failures, it is a win-win. That from Teresa.
I have to say something about that, Joe. I mean, sure. This whole notion that, oh, we're going to rob them of their natural resources. I mean, I just think that's very silly, actually. And yes, American companies like a Chevron would be very, very they have the expertise and the knowledge to bring Venezuela's oil production back to where it should be. But that doesn't mean that in a market economy that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, this would also bring a lot of prosperity to the Venezuelan economy and to the Venezuelan people. So I don't really think that there's no great advantage to the United States. We're not, quote unquote, taking their oil. I would note that the Maduro regime is threatening with their Cuban friends Guyana next door to Venezuela, attempting to take their proven oil reserves, which have been discovered in recent years. They're attempting to take those by force. So again, it comes back to you have a criminal regime that's illegitimate, first under Hugo Chavez and now under Maduro. And it would be great if he departed the scene.
Marion writes to us and says Venezuela may be trading one dictatorship for another. Trump will not fight to install freedom in Venezuela while he destroys it in the U.S. His goal is control, and he will take the oil. That from Marion. Then we go to this letter from Vincent. It is about narco-terrorism, as Trump and Hegseth say. Is the next step to start taking out 18-wheelers and drug mule vehicles coming from Mexico? Most of the drugs that come in cross the Mexican border, and it's driven by the insatiable demand in our country. Also, it's not extreme gerrymandering. Is not extreme gerrymandering a form of election rigging right here? Asks Vincent.
Yes. I mean, I think we could have spend a lot of time talking about gerrymandering. One of the interesting things about the complexity of the Venezuelan story is the fact that I'm curious what the appetite will be for Americans and for the press on this particular topic. It seems right now, it seems like it's run a course that is roughly equal to, I counted the days, roughly equal to the original Signal chat story back several months ago. And then that Hegseth mistake, maybe illegal, ended up sort of dying out. Now it's come back a little bit. So the question is, will there be legs on the war crimes / shooting down Venezuelan boats, Hegseth dodging the Congress members yesterday? How much legs will there be before we move on to another thing? I'm not sure that this one is the story that's going to sink the Secretary of Defense.
Do you think?
Well, we all know that the attention span of the American people is about 10 seconds. So the media and the news move so quickly today from one controversy or issue to another that it's hard to say how much attention will be paid on any of these things, 6 months from now.
Well, yes.
I think it's noticeable that Republicans, again, there are Republicans who are asking for these videos to be released. There are Republicans who also express a concern about the legality of the attacks on the boats, and specifically the second strike. So I do think that we're seeing, over the last few weeks, and of course the Epstein files play into that tremendously, but the height of the Trump era is over. So I do think that this particular experience, even though it is related to international relations, which is oftentimes too abstract for many Americans to pay too much attention to, but I do think it is one puzzle piece that will lead to a new era and the end of the height of the Trump era.
I don't disagree with you, Karen, that we're sort of seeing a waning of Trumpism generally. But I was struck by the fact that, what was it, a week ago, guys? It was a week ago that the video was shown to a bipartisan group of Congress members, and the Republicans came out and said, nothing to see here. So, there are Republicans who still are sort of dogged on this particular topic, but there's a whole bunch of Republicans who sort of thought maybe that there was something there, and now they're unwilling to sort of step up and continue the fight. So I think this is part of a general pattern of the GOP to raise alarm and then step back from the precipice.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue more topics, more letters, and just all around more fun. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Have a good one going with Bo Breslin, John Faso, and Dr. Karen Riedel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your letters. Let's move on to other topics on this Wednesday morning. We go to the question of health care and what's going to happen with subsidies and what's going to happen in votes to create with Obamacare. Senate Republicans plan to offer a proposal that would create a new payment for people with bare bones health coverage, clashing with Democrats who are pressing for an extension of existing tax credits. This, of course, all came out of the shutdown and what was agreed to as to actually bring these things to a vote. So Senate Republicans trying to counter Democrats on rising health insurance premiums intend to hold a vote this week on a plan that would allow Affordable Care Act tax credits to expire at the end of the year and instead send money for health care costs directly to Americans who purchase bare bones health insurance coverage. Senator John Thune, the South Dakota Republican and majority leader, said on Tuesday that Republicans would offer the legislation written by the Republican senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Mike Crapo of Idaho, as their alternative to a Democratic proposal for a three-year extension of tax credits enacted during the pandemic. But proposals are expected to come to a vote on Thursday, part of a commitment that Republicans made to Democrats last month in exchange for ending the government shutdown. But, and here's the key to it all, but neither is likely to draw the 60 votes necessary to advance, making it all but certain that the subsidies will expire at the end of the year with no action by Congress. The Republican measure would replace the expanded tax credits with a program that would provide direct payments to Americans earning less than 700% of the federal poverty level who purchase health insurance plans with high deductibles and low premiums. The payments, which would be deposited into tax advantage health savings accounts, would be $1,000 for people aged 18 to 49, $1,500 for those 50 to 64. People could spend the money as they see fit on medical services, but none of it could be used toward abortion services or gender treatments. That reporting from the New York Times. John Faso, why don't you take first swing at that?
Well, as I've said before on this program, Joe, the enhanced premium tax credits under the so-called Affordable Care Act, which has not turned out to be affordable, those were enacted as a temporary measure during the pandemic. And it basically it's extraordinarily expensive, these expanded tax credits. It would cost about $360 billion over a 10-year period to keep the pandemic-era spending levels going forward. And just simply extending those tax credits doesn't make sense, especially last week. I don't know if you covered this previously, Joe, but the General Accounting Office, the Government Accountability Office, as it's called today, identified numerous problems with the existing tax credit system. In fact, what they did is they created fictitious accounts both in 2024 and 2025. And I'll just read you from something I had pulled up. In plan year 2025, they created 20 fictitious accounts, fictitious applicants. 18 remained actively covered as of September of this year. And the tax credits for these 18 enrollees total over $10,000 a month. They also identified hundreds of thousands of examples of potential Social Security number misuse. And so there are incredible problems with the way in which the these tax credits, the enhanced tax credits, have been administered. And frankly, the fraud that is taking place is done often by brokers who sell policies and churn people in these programs. The GAO's analysis also identified at least 30,000 applications in plan year 23 and at least 160,000 applications in plan year 2024 that likely had unauthorized changes by agents and brokers. So I encourage your listeners to read this preliminary report that the GAO did. They just really skimmed the surface on the problems with the way in which these tax credits are administered. And it's not all that dissimilar from the earned income tax credit, which when I last looked at this a couple of years ago, the fraud in among those tax credit applications was in the neighborhood of 25% of all of the program applications for the earned income tax credit. So there are real administrative problems with how the tax credit, the current system, runs. And it's very inefficient. And certainly, I think Democrats need to answer why should temporary tax credits that were adopted during the pandemic, why should those temporary tax credits continue despite the fact that the pandemic has been over for at least 2 years?
You were nice enough to send me a couple of stories on this report when it first came out from the GAO. And I was reading it, and I'm fascinated by it, because obviously you ask most people, they don't want fraud. They don't want it to be a fraudulent system. They want it to be a fair system for everyone. One of the headlines that came out of the report is that the GAO found dead people on the rolls for Obamacare and so forth. I'll be 58 in a couple of in a week or so. It strikes me as I've heard this since the beginning of time, that there's always going to be a certain amount of fraud within the system, and I just don't know. So do you throw the baby out with the bathwater? Is it
no.
And I'm not saying that there isn't room and that changes shouldn't be made. I'm just wondering that whatever system you do indeed come up with, for example, just giving people money and saying, here, use this, except for these few things, will there not be fraud inherent in that?
There always will be, Joe. I've also said on this program before, the basic problem that we have with our health insurance system is that it's really not insurance. It's really an indemnity plan. Insurance, you think of, you're getting a car accident, your house burns down, you have a catastrophic event, and you buy insurance to cover that. But what we've done with health insurance, we've completely separated the consumer of the health insurance and the provider from having any economic relationship with each other. Because you go into the doctor and the doctor prescribes something, you don't ask what the price is, and the doctor never tells you what the price is, because oftentimes he doesn't even know. We've relied on third-party payers to pay the bills, even for routine medical treatments. And so separating, having no economic relationship between the provider and the consumer, means that the costs are inevitably going to go up. You know what? It's always easier to spend someone else's money. And when the provider doesn't care what it costs and the consumer doesn't care what it costs, guess what? That's why we have this mess of our insurance system today. Now, I think what really Congress on a bipartisan basis should be doing is taking a really close look at this, maybe put some reforms, income limits, for instance, in on the premium tax credits, and really look at the way in which the program is structured, because the way the program is structured, you have much higher increases on these Affordable Care Act plans than you do in the commercial market, where, you know, 22 million people get these Affordable Care Act tax credit programs, and 155 million people get employer-provided health insurance. And why is it that the rates of employer-provided insurance have gone up much lower than the Affordable Care Act plans? It's because the Affordable Care Act plans are misdesigned. They're not designed properly. And just simply throwing more money at this problem, which is what the House and Senate Democrats want to do right now, I don't think is smart financially, but it also doesn't begin to even address the problem.
I'm struck by what you just said, though, as far as the providers, the doctors who are often, let's say, prescribing a medication. And if I get a heart medication and they give me a prescription and I walk out with a, well, it's not a piece of paper anymore, but a digital prescription. And if I fill it at pharmacy A, it's going to cost me $80. If I do it at pharmacy B, it's going to be $10. And if I do it at pharmacy C, it's going to cost me $12,000. And I just, but like, how does that make sense for people? Because everyone has that story, right? Everyone has. How many times does somebody come up with you and come up to you and tell you the donut hole story? Like, it just sure. happens all the time. And so those are the things that it seemed to be. And I realize it's extremely complex. I just don't know how you eventually address this in a way that is it going to be. Here's my direct question, John. By giving people, as John Thune is saying, by giving people, let's say, $1,000 or $1,500, is that going to solve a problem, or is that money going to be tapped out really, really quickly?
Well, it begins to address the issue of giving the health consumer the responsibility to assess, well, what is the price going to be if I get this prescription filled here as opposed to over there? Whenever you're spending your own money, you tend to be more prudent with how you spend the money, and you tend to ask the price for something. But, you know, this is a this is the fundamental problem with the system as we've created it. And it's not really insurance as you have for your automobile or your home. It's a first dollar coverage is what we've gotten accustomed to. And the amount of bureaucracy and detail and complexity that is introduced into our system, the way we've set it up, the costs continue to skyrocket. And I think it's simply a function of the idea behind what John Thune and Bill Cassidy, Senator Cassidy, who's a very responsible guy, senator from Louisiana, yes, trying to deal with these issues. They're trying to get the consumer more involved in what the costs are, have more transparency in what the costs are. And obviously, you can't, you know, if someone has a big medical emergency, an operation, a heart attack, whatever it is, a broken leg, you know, they're not going to be able to have the money to cover that. Those are the kind of catastrophic events why we all need health insurance. But I think we need to be of a mind to start thinking about how do we get more price transparency, and how do we get, you know, 250 million healthcare consumers in the country interested in what something costs, and reduce and put more pressure on costs that way. The other big issue we have, frankly, that no one is addressing, Joe, is we don't have enough doctors, nurses, medical providers in our aging society, and this problem is going to get worse. And the number of people who, you know, lose a primary care physician, for instance, because they retire, it's very difficult to find a new one. I've gone through this myself.
Yes, me too.
And you know, that's a big issue that really no one is really addressing properly at the federal or state level.
No, agreed. And the other problem too is that if you don't have that person, then you go on the phone and they say, well, go to the ER. And there you are in a huge system with all of these people and taking up resources. And by the way, I think if you go in there for just a cough, you could come out. Your $1,000 account could be drained in 2 seconds with a Band-Aid and a ginger ale. But Bo.
Yeah, part of the way through that conversation, John, I was jumping on the John Faso for Congress bandwagon.
Where did that bandwagon go, John? Do you still have that in the garage?
There's no more instruments on that bandwagon.
That said, I'm going to take a slightly different tact on this one because I'm frustrated from a political perspective, not necessarily. I am frustrated from an insurance and a medical perspective, too. But I'm frustrated from a political perspective. And I think this story, Joe, is indicative of just how broken Washington currently is. And let me try to put a couple of pieces together. One, as folks know, Lisa Murkowski and a group of Congress members, senators, and I guess Congress members generally, had a plan for a shorter runway for the subsidies, 2 years as opposed to 3 years. That didn't even get the GOP's support. Instead, they went with the Bill Cassidy, maybe for the reason John's talking about, when it's in your bank account, you're going to be more responsible for it. But Lisa Murkowski's plan strikes me as a more, I think, tangible plan for Republicans to jump on board, maybe lower the amount of subsidies over the 2 years and, have a step down process instead of just pulling the rug out from under. Secondly, this seems like a pattern at some level. Right. And the pattern, maybe two is not a good enough pattern, but the pattern looks like this. Government shuts down. Democrats are the ones sort of in the minority. They're seeking to get a vote on a thing that they care about. When John was in Congress in 2018, it went exactly like this. Right. Government shut down. Democrats wanted a vote on Dreamers or a path to citizenship. They got the promise. Democrats caved, opened the government, and no progress was made because you can't get past the filibuster. Three, the fact of the matter is that what was at one time central to American politics, especially American legislative politics, that the moderates were the ones who held the bulk of the power is now no longer in play. That, I think, is a larger tragic issue of the current state of American politics. John Fetterman on the left, Lisa Murkowski on the right, they are no longer the players in the way that 30, 40 years ago, moderates were the major players and the major influencers. I think that's a shame if you're sitting there because of a variety of reasons, whether it's the press or whether because we like the extreme stories. If you're on the margins of these political parties in Congress, you have outsized influence, not reflective of the American population, which tends to be bell curve in the middle, and the Fettermans and Lisa Murkowskis of the world are oftentimes either ignored or simply stifled in their proposals. Finally, I'll say this to John. Yeah, it costs a lot of money, right? I get it that this whole issue costs a lot of money. The Department of Defense budget is way more than the subsidies, the loss of revenue that comes in from the subsidies. And we make choices. To me, healthcare for the X number of millions of people trying to stay on Obamacare with a lower rate is more important than some of the costs we incur on the Department of Defense budget. That's just a choice. I probably wouldn't get voted into Congress, but you can't tell me that these particular costs are so extravagant that we're going to target those as opposed to some of the other areas in which we, I think, spend beyond our means.
Karen.
both beautifully said, but I am going to agree with John as well that our healthcare system is highly problematic. Right? It's like whether we're going to fix the system, the problems with the banded approach of subsidies or the banded approach that the GOP is proposing right now with a payment of $1,000 to $1,500. It doesn't really matter. It's the structural problems of our healthcare systems will still not be addressed. The cost of our healthcare system will still not be addressed. I agree with all because it's as a society we make choices and I certainly agree that our choice needs to be to protect the most vulnerable, which inevitably, and this is what makes it so frustrating, because neither one, whether the subsidies or the $1,000 to $1,500 payments, will not be approved. They will not receive the 60 votes, the necessary 60 votes in the Senate. In the end, we will have millions of people uninsured or uninsured again. And that is something that we as a society will all suffer from.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the program and have 1.5 hour left to get to some more issues, plus your letters on this topic as well. Many of those coming in, not surprisingly. We'll get to all of it right after this short break.
Well, I'm the first to say,
good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 10th day of December. It's 34 minutes past 10 o'clock, a Wednesday, and we have Bo Breslin, John Fasso, and Dr. Karen Riedel with us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's get to some letters in regards to our conversation regarding, the healthcare. Rosemary says, when I was seeking an MRI for a concussion and this in a brain fog that lasted for over a year, I should have been price comparing? That from Rosemary. Then we go to Ellen. It does not make sense to want the consumer more involved. Take two. It does make sense to want the consumer more involved. However, doctors routinely list a very high charge for a service, which then the insurance company has negotiated to a lower charge, and they accept that. Only the uninsured person ends up paying $550 for a simple consultation, while the insurance company pays the doctor $125. Until this is rectified, it's extremely difficult for a person to get catastrophic insurance and cover the rest of their bills out of pocket. That from Ellen. We go to Leslie. I'm a 58-year-old woman who is facing not having health insurance next year. My husband is on Medicare, and my adult disabled son is on Medicaid. We can't afford over $1,200 a month with a $10,000 deductible. I'm lucky that I'm fairly healthy. Can the panel discuss the real-world implications of what is about to happen? Anybody want to take that? I wouldn't either, but I'm just asking.
Well, I've read the stories of the price increase that's going to go up when the subsidies go away, and you know it's 3, 4, 5 times monthly increase in cost, maybe more in some cases, but most of the stories that I read of people, and these are selected by the press. The monthly increase is going to be not exponential, but it's going to be multi times, and that's problematic for anybody who's trying to make ends meet in other ways with rent or mortgage or high prices for food and so on. So that's where I think the problem is, and I feel for those folks who are going to face those costs on January 1st.
Yeah, Joe, could I add something as well?
Of course.
If you have employer-provided health insurance, you are not taxed as on that benefit that you've received. employer-provided health insurance is exempt from taxation to that individual. And the same thing should be also done for other people who have to buy insurance themselves. It should be with pre-tax dollars, not after-tax dollars. And that would be one way to address this problem. Part of what Senator Cassidy and others are talking about with health savings accounts, those would be pre-tax dollars that could be used to purchase medical insurance, could be used to purchase medical services, et cetera. And clearly $1,200 or $1,500, whatever the number is not going to be enough. But we have to start thinking about how we finance these things and the comparability of the tax exclusion for employer-provided health insurance, which is not made available to someone who might be having to buy insurance themselves. Now, in New York State, because of state regulatory policies, the state has over the last 30 years basically destroyed the individual market for insurance. That's a topic for an entire other day, not today. But I feel for those people too. I just would like folks to understand that the enhanced premium tax credits were adopted as a temporary measure because of the pandemic. The pandemic is over. So now we have to come up with a different system. We can't just simply extend the pandemic era spending because, frankly, that's an expense that is out of line. And given, I encourage everyone, look at the GAO report. Go online. You can see it. And it just skims the tip of the iceberg in terms of the problems with the existing system as it's laid out.
But, John, let me ask this question then. I get that, and I've been on the show with you a couple times where you've said that, and I think, you know, there's wisdom there. It was temporary. It was meant to lapse and so on. But if it was doing a good job in terms of providing opportunity for folks to get access to medical coverage at a reasonable price, why do we focus on the temporary nature of it? Why not extend it? And as I said before, make other choices to save money, the government money, funding. I just think the temporary nature is kind of a hollow argument.
Well, I mean, there was enormous spending that was undertaken during the pandemic, and much of it was justified. But we also know there was enormous fraud that took place because of that extra spending during the pandemic. For instance, we didn't re-verify people's eligibility for Medicaid for over 3 years. Now that's changing. The Biden administration reinstituted verification for Medicaid eligibility. That was appropriate. But, you know, the unemployment insurance system, there was massive fraud in the unemployment insurance system, well documented all across the country. And similarly, take a look at that GAO report. It would be irresponsible for Congress to just simply extend the existing system, knowing that there's such problems. Now, I think the compromise that Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Brian Fitzpatrick in the House, and together with some Democrats are working on extending the tax credits for a year or even 2 years, but doing it in a way where the income eligibility is restored. Because right now, what happened with the enhanced premium tax credits, a number of private employers decided to get rid of their employer-provided health insurance because the enhanced tax credits were giving people health insurance coverage for much less than even employer-provided health insurance. So there are real problems with the extension. Typically, Republicans have not explained them well enough. A lot of my Republican colleagues, whenever the health insurance issue comes up, rush to duck their heads in the sand and pretend the issue will go away. That's not going to go away. The last thing I will say is that, yes, we have a lot of financing problems and issues with our health insurance system, but the systems that in England and other places where you have a government-run system, they're also in many of the same problems in terms of shortages, in terms of rationing care, in terms of inability to get certain services, and financial difficulties. And you see this both in the UK and elsewhere.
Karen.
All right. There are many different models, and the UK system isn't fully government funded anymore. The difference between our system and other systems and other well-established democracies is that everybody is covered, and the level of undercoverage that we have here in the United States is also not prevalent. And as Paul pointed out, there is just it's difficult to comprehend that services cost so much more for individuals who end up paying for the services than it does cost for the insurances. That there is an opening for a debate that we as a society need to have. What is going wrong in our system in the richest country in the world, where so many people are uninsured, there will be many more moving forward? What is going wrong, given that the cost for individuals in the United States is twice as high as the cost for individuals in any of these other countries where healthcare is universal? We didn't seem to be having these kinds of conversations. The conversations that we're having is what kind of Band-Aid are we going to put on the system to carry it over for the next few months, for the next year? Now, what I couldn't find out is the difference in cost. Sean, you're talking about the costs and obviously the need to be addressed. Again, that our healthcare costs are so much higher than in any other countries. But it's the Band-Aid that the GOP is suggesting, which will not be approved by the Senate, of $1,000-$1,500 payment. How does it compare? I can see that what I could find out is that pretty much everybody who has been getting subsidies will be eligible to receive the $1,000-$1,500 based on the age group. How does the actual cost for the government compare? Are we going to save money by handing out $1,000-$1,500 as compared to continuing with the subsidies? And then one more issue that I'd like to address is the notion that we the people need to take charge of our not just our healthcare, but to actually push for a change from the bottom up. I do strongly feel that this is where our representatives come in. This is why we have a government and a democratic system in particular. I expect our representatives to take the lead in that regard, to identify the root causes of the problems in our systems and attempt to address the root causes.
John, I know you have to go before we hit a break, but anything you want to say on that before you head out?
No, I think Karen raises a lot of good points. Bo, you too. I don't want to leave you out on that, but
I do think the
fundamental issue that we have to face is cost and transparency, but we also need to address issues such as how are we going to find the medical providers that we need? And again, we didn't even, I alluded to it, but we didn't really get into much of the problem that we have here in New York State. It emanates from Albany, and the way in which New York State has wrecked the individual insurance market through the years is really a scandal. And, you know, the state of New York is also one of the only states in the country that actually taxes health insurance premiums that are paid by employers. It's all about over $6 billion a year. Most people, I'm sure most of your listeners, don't even know that New York secretly taxes health insurance. And that's another thing that drives up costs here in New York State.
John Fesso, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. Be well. Have a beautiful holiday if
Thank
I don't
you.
See you beforehand.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you and everyone.
Take care. Thanks, John. We'll be back with Bo and Karen and wrap up our conversation. Many more letters to get to on this subject. Maybe we can even sneak in another topic as well. We'll do all of that when we return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. About 10 minutes left with our group. And I thought instead of going to another subject, we'll try to keep to some letters because we have a lot on the subject. And I,
I think it's something we haven't discussed in a bit. We talk about it all the time, but it has been a little while, and there's some new developments, so I would like to stick with it because there are a lot of questions. Let's begin with Bruce. I have a very hard time buying the idea that putting the burden on sick people is trying to shop around for better prices is the solution to rising healthcare costs. To the best of my knowledge, no other developed country does this, and almost every other developed country spends less on healthcare per capita than the U.S. and gets better healthcare outcomes. Karen, I think that's the point you were making of as far as that this is where leadership comes in and helping the people out to get the care they deserve. All right. We'll take a pause. Okay. We'll try to get Karen back. Let's go to Jeffrey, who says, it needs to be emphasized that there's a huge area in between consumers being more connected to the cost of their prescriptions and the coverage they should have for catastrophic medical needs like surgery or a heart attack. If people are going to be forced to be more discerning with what they spend on, they're going to begin putting off doctor visits for symptoms that may be something serious. I mean, that's always a concern, obviously, isn't it? Mary says, I find it amazing that Republicans like John Faso can focus on waste and abuse when it comes to individual people in the ACA, but the waste and abuse that is going on right now with the daily expenditure of sending our military to Venezuela, total silence from Republicans on that account.
Yeah, and Joe, I think, I mean, that's that point. I'll just riff off of that letter from Mary. You know, you did mention, I think Republicans tend to fall on the or at least shield themselves with the it's all fraud conversation a little bit more than the actual reality out there. The other thing that I would though add to this is the role of special interests in American politics. You know, it is not surprising to me that as Karen said, as you said, and even as John admitted, that other countries, less well-off countries, are doing slightly better, or in some cases, pretty significantly better on healthcare than we are. Those are tend to be countries where the healthcare system is at least public to a certain extent. The UK, Karen's right, the UK is not fully public anymore. But those tend to be countries that have less special interests that are driving the conversation. And I think as long as we have special interests and lobbyists and so on with big dollars in the game, we're never going to solve this in the way in which it helps the regular American citizen.
Karen, just checking that you're back with us.
I'm back. Okay. My apologies.
No worries. Yes.
No, it's so sad that we here cannot have actual real discussions on real alternatives that do exist, that are not just government funded. There are so many models, like looking at the German model, for example, that are, you know, largely based on employment-based insurance programs, but always with that that backing from the government to ensure that everybody is insured and insured in a way that really covers the services that people need and don't leave people rolling into the operation room being told that, by the way, whether your anesthesia is covered, we can't tell you. You need to figure it out yourself. I mean, this is like a common occurrence. It's happened to me. So clearly, the system is deeply broken and we're not having discussions about real alternatives and what the real problems are, and instead we are both on the left and the right are talking about band-aids to fix the system that needs to be entirely overhauled. So I leave you with a brief story of a time when I was in Europe and ended up with a thorn in my eye, which is horrifying. And I went to Europe without insurance and silly me, because I assumed nothing was going to happen. So I had to go to a doctor to have the thorn removed. I called them, told them I didn't have insurance. I was met with great concern and asked whether I was planning on paying for the entire bill right away. And I came into the office with every dollar that, or every euro that I brought, some 500 euros. And I said, well, if I have enough, then I will pay it now. And the bill ended up being 25 euros, about $28. So I added some services that would have cost me more here for the co-payments I have to pay. There are alternatives, and I wish we as a society would consider them more seriously. And one more issue: if there is fraud, and if we can identify the fraud, and if we can clearly identify the fraud with data, why can't we fight the fraud rather than the system that protects so many people?
Yeah, I agree. Fix the problem. The other thing that I know it's not this simple, but I'm going to throw it out. I mean, America, especially in the 20th century, had a history of providing social safety nets for folks, right? So whether it's Social Security or minimum wage, maximum hour legislation, New Deal type stuff, we have a tradition of providing, and I'll even go to things like the GI Bill and so on, we have a tradition of providing social safety nets for folks. What happened to that tradition when it comes to insurance? Obamacare was an attempt to do that, right? And Obamacare was an attempt to provide that safety net for folks who were slipping through the cracks. What I cannot understand is how Democrats and Republicans can't figure out what is a moderate, middle-of-the-road answer to what is a long-standing tradition of providing safety nets for those who need it.
Let's go to a couple of letters as we wrap up here. Margarita says, stop, stop, stop. Or am I missing something? How is it okay to extend the temporary tax cuts to the wealthy, but not extend tax credits for the Affordable Health Care Act? Fraud can be dealt with by hiring competent, ethical people to go after, you know, fraud. Yeah, that costs money, but everything does. That from Margarita. We then go to Leslie. Why can't we extend the temporary credits while we work at fixing the system? It sounds to me like we're just going to take this support away and continue to do nothing to come up with solutions. That from Leslie. We check in with Matthew. It appears that when government gets involved, health insurance costs go up, but when government is not involved, we lose access. I suggest there are two parallel issues. First, we do not allow government to effectively regulate health insurance to require coverage to everyone and prohibit cherry-picking healthy individuals. Second, the for-profit health insurance marketplace encourages rising costs and rising profits. Rick says, just like the federal government failed to act on immigration and we ended up with the deplorable mess we have now, failing to reform health care will result in the same. We should have Medicare for all and an opportunity to purchase additional insurance, like Germany, for example, and stop bankrupting sick people and enriching insurance companies. We got this from Fabian, who says, oh, John Faso. There is rampant fraud and corruption within the Defense Department and military contractors. Do we do away with the Defense Department as you suggest we do away with the healthcare subsidies? That from Fabian. We go into, we check in with another John without an H. It is the corporate control of health insurance that brings the cost of healthcare up, not government bureaucracy. And fraud is rampant in private insurance. I know, as I worked for one of the largest health insurers, Obamacare is a compromise. I have seen the broken layers of corporate bureaucracy at work. It is not just the government bureaucracy as the culprit. If the government is in complete control of the healthcare system, as in Medicare for All, at least the bureaucracy is working for the people of the United States, not the stockholders of the corporation. We'll let John have the last word on this Wednesday morning. My thanks to our wonderful panelist, John Faso, of course,
who left a moment ago. We also thank Bo Breslin and Karen Riedel. Thank you both. Good to talk to you. Thank you. We'll be back with another hour of the Roundtable right after this.